Hello and welcome in.
First science. Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Hello and welcome to Science Mixtape with me, Kyle Major. Know thyself is frequently seen alongside many anatomical drawings, and this quest for self-understanding through anatomy is as relevant today as it was when the father of anatomy, Andrea Vesalius, was producing drawings in the 16th century. Anatomical drawings have always fascinated and are more popular now than ever, seen everywhere from t-shirts to tattoos. Emily Evans is an anatomist, an artist who has been teaching anatomy for over a decade. She's also behind several books, ranging from an up-to-date take on anatomical art to a dissection of the modern trend for these anatomical tattoos. She's also the brains behind Anatomy Boutique, which produces wallpapers, ceramics, fabrics, and more, all inspired by the human body and how we represent it. We will be discussing all this while we sample some of Emily's musical tastes along the way. So, for our little heart to art, welcome, Emily.
Hello.
Good to have you here. Also, producing today, we've got Louise. And to fire up that grey matter and get us started, Louise has got a little brain teaser for us. What do we have this week?
I've actually only thought a little bit about it for now. I want to tease it a little bit longer, and I'm going to give it to you later.
Okay, fair enough. So in that case, we're going to go straight on to our first song, which is your choice, Emily. It is The Levellers and The Boatman.
But these things are so hard for me. I cannot choose my own destiny. And all the things that I want to see.
The human skeleton is the internal framework of the body. It is composed of 270 bones at birth. This total decreases to 206 bones by adulthood after some bones have fused together. So, as I said, I'm going to tease you with that brain teaser now. So, we've got bulbs of Krauss, camphus, legfum, and glabella.
So, are we asking for how many of those are actually real body parts?
Yeah, so...
Okay.
Right. They all sound a bit crazy, don't they? I'm not sure any of them are.
Yeah, I'm not sure any of them are. Can we have them one more time?
So we've got bulbs of Krauss, camphus, legfum, and glabella.
Cool. So if you know that, do tweet in to at Soho Radio or at Science Mixtape, and we'll try and figure out who's right. Emily, thank you. Welcome. How did you get into fusing anatomy and art? It seems quite strange.
So I went to Sheffield University to study anatomy for my degree, and I'd always really loved art. Both my parents were artists, so even the whole time I was doing my anatomy degree, I was in the dissection room drawing, and I was director of the Arts Council at the university. So the two of them always seemed to go really nicely together. But when I graduated from university, I think like a lot of science graduates, I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my science degree. I didn't really want to go into research. So I became a secondary school science teacher in East London for a while. And then out of nowhere, one of my tutors at Cambridge University published some of the images I'd been working on while I was doing my degree in an anatomy book. Oh. And it was a bit of a light bulb moment when I was staring at my rabble of a GCSE class and realised that actually I really missed pure anatomy and that I'd really like to illustrate medical textbooks. So I quit teaching and trained with the Medical Artists Association of Great Britain to be a medical illustrator, and at the same time started teaching human dissection, so as a senior demonstrator of anatomy at St George's University in London. And once I got my kind of qualification in medical illustration, I set up my own company illustrating medical textbooks.
So you've been doing that illustration for a while now, and you've also been teaching anatomy. Where are you teaching at the moment?
I teach at Cambridge now. So I moved up to Cambridge briefly for a while about 12 years ago and started teaching at Cambridge University and haven't left.
All right. So, and I mean, this is like full dissection with, you know, whole cadavers that people do. How does it work over a year or so?
Yeah, so at Cambridge, we're one of the few medical schools, and there's only about 11 left in the UK now that teach whole body dissection, which means that a donor will bequeath their body to us for a period of time, often a year, sometimes longer if they're happy for us to retain some body parts for teaching. And the students, we have about 50 bodies donated a year to Cambridge University. We have 300 students a year. So we have tables of around 6 students around each cadaver. And throughout the entire academic year, they dissect that person from head to toe, as it were, not necessarily in that order. But by the end of the academic year, the students then have a committal service with the body where they get to find out a little bit about that donor, maybe pictures of their dog or their relatives, find out more about them, which the students find quite emotional.
Yeah, I imagine if you've spent a whole year kind of getting to know someone in a kind of weird way, you know, getting to know their body inside, literally inside out, and then suddenly you find out about their whole life, that must be quite a thing for them.
Yeah, it's something that the students find very emotional, because for the first time the dissection tables are moved out of the dissection room and all the bodies are put in coffins. So it's the first time I think they really equate that situation with a living person with family, and they find it quite emotional. But for us, it's important because they are going to be doctors, and it's important that this was their first patient essentially, and they need to learn that Every patient has relatives and has a life, and they find it really interesting and really rewarding that they found out more about that person and why they wanted to bequeath their body.
So, I mean, that's one string to your bow, that teaching anatomy. Mm-hmm. You've also have recently opened Anatomy Boutique. What's that, and how did you transition from this kind of pure anatomical medical textbooks teaching anatomy into something that's a bit more art based?
Yeah, so for about 10 years, I was just purely illustrating medical textbooks such as Grey's Anatomy and other academic texts from UK medical publishers. And because I run my own business and I don't want to go bonkers working from home, I work from creative studios, different creative studios in London, and I get to meet lots of different creative people doing different practices, and I like to collaborate with them. So Anatomy Boutique, my shop, started through a couple of collaborations with some colleagues. One was making a wallpaper and one was making some ceramics, and they weren't initially for an online shop or anything, they were for an event, but people really loved them and they got on social media and people wanted to know where to buy them. And I started thinking about how anatomy could be taken out of academic textbooks and reframed into something that was a bit more lifestyle based, so that the beautiful patterns and the beautiful imageries could be appreciated purely for their aesthetics. So
as art in themselves.
Yes, exactly. So really nice kind of colours and patterns. And so I started playing around with that. And what began with wallpaper and a few ceramics with human histological slides on has now grown into many different products, from silk scarves and cushions to stationery, tea towels.
Brilliant. So we're going to be talking about all of this later. First off, next, we're going to have your next song, which was The Doors, Break On Through. Why did you choose this one?
Yeah, so The Doors I discovered, like I think a lot of people did in their teens. And for me, Jim Morrison's lyrics, he was the first person that I really heard of that would talk about death really in their lyrics quite a lot. He was quite obsessed with death and what it is to be human, and really pushing his humanity to the other side. And yeah, I found that quite fascinating.
You know, the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, yeah. Chased our pleasures here, dug our treasures there. But can you still recall the time we cried? Break on through to the other side. Break on through.
25% of a human's bones are in the hands and the feet.
Wow. That's quite a lot. I feel like we use our hands and our feet quite a lot, so it's probably quite useful that a lot of bones are in there. We normally do an experiment on the show, but we were thinking that maybe doing some real-life, you know, dissection would be quite messy all over the equipment. Some of it's quite expensive. So we had a few demonstrations to kind of show a little bit about anatomy that we can that you can actually do. Could you give us something to do, Emily?
So one of the things that we do with our students is we talk about the power grip. So this is the grip that if you're going to kind of hammer something or hold a handrail, if you clench your fist, you automatically notice that you extend your wrist at the same time. That is, you kind of straighten your wrist and arm at the same time. If you try to flex your wrist, which is bending your wrist forward, you'll find that your power grip becomes really weak. You can't really grip things as strongly. So that's one of the fundamental things that makes us human, is having these kind of union of all the muscles working together to make a really strong grip so that we can make things and do things.
And that only happens in that one position. And is that just, is there a kind of mechanical reason for that? Is that the structure of the bones or the muscles, or?
It's to do with the muscles, in that it's quite difficult for the flexors in the forearm to flex the fingers if they're essentially bent over. They work much better if they're straight.
So everything kind of has to be nice and lined up for it to work in the right way.
Exactly.
So there was one that I saw, which is, so if you place your palm on a surface and then lift each of your fingers individually, so first, middle, ring, pinky, you can lift them all up. Now, if you take your middle finger and you tuck it under your palm, so that it's kind of tucked under, now try and lift the fingers that are remaining sticking out. So first finger, ring, I can't lift my ring finger. It's very difficult. And is there a reason behind that? Why can't you lift that finger when your middle finger's tucked under?
Yeah, so your four fingers, so what you're trying to do is what we call extending the fingers, where you're lifting them off the table. And that's done by one muscle. So all of those fingers are extended by one muscle, which is extensor digitorum communis. So essentially, that works perfectly if you're trying to do them all at the same time or individually. But if you tuck one under, essentially stretching that muscle, so it's kind of at full stretch. So then in order for it to try and flex, to try and lift up the other ones, it's very difficult for it to do it individually.
Right, so because they share a muscle, they can't kind of do things on their own. They have to do them together.
Not as easily, no.
So we also mentioned before something about how when you're opening a door, it's much easier with a bent arm than it is with a straight arm. What was this?
So we have a movement called supination and pronation, which is where you're turning your palm of your hand either palm upwards or palm downwards. And most of the movements we do, such as opening a door, unscrewing something, unscrewing a jam jar, pronation and supination is done by biceps brachii in that position, which is a very, as we know, it's a very strong muscle in the upper arm.
That's the kind of standard, like, strongman, let me show you my biceps.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the guns.
The guns, yeah. that's the technical term.
Exactly. That's what we call it. So you rarely do something like that with your arm fully extended. If you fully extend your arm, you don't have the same power to pronate and supinate, turn your wrist, essentially. So that's why we tend to do most of those kind of forceful movements with a bent arm, because it's biceps that's doing it.
Right. So, I mean, all these little tiny things tell us a little bit about anatomy, but obviously to really understand it, you have to get inside and cut someone open, right?
I think that helps, yeah.
Yeah. All right, well, we're not going to do that here. We're just going to move on to our next song, which is Clara Nunes, Portela na Avenida. Why did you choose this one?
Yeah, so I had a pretty major obsession with Brazilian music and samba in my late 20s and early 30s, to the point where I moved to Brazil and used to go play carnival every year and love playing Brazilian music and learned to dance to Brazilian music. And for about 5 years, most of my evenings and weekends were spent gigging, playing Brazilian music. And so I don't do that so much anymore because work's kind of taken over. But this song by Clara Nunes, Portela na Avenida, is my favourite samba song to dance to. Portela, sobre a tua bandeira esse divino manto, tua águia altaneira, Espírito Santo, no tempo do samba, as pastoras e os pastores vêm chegando da cidade, da favela, para defender as tuas cores, como fiéis na santa missa da capela.
There's only one bone in the body that isn't connected to any other bones, the hyoid bone. It sits above your larynx.
Emily, you've been illustrating for medical textbooks for quite a long time, and how is anatomy illustration different from other forms of illustration? And like, what makes it unique?
So when you're illustrating for medical textbooks, you're usually having to normalise anatomy in some way. So you're not necessarily drawing something as it appears in real life exactly, because you're trying to show an average representation of something. So just as we know that we have two eyes, a nose and a mouth, and everyone has that on their face, we also know that there's differences between everybody's faces, and your organs and anatomy is exactly the same. So when it comes to illustrating for a textbook, we kind of have to take an average, normalise that in some way. And if we're trying to show, for example, a surgical procedure, then the illustrations need to be quite technical and quite diagrammatic. They're not necessarily showing exactly what it would look like in real life. They're trying to show exactly where a stitch would go or exactly where you would cut something. So they're quite informative, diagrammatic illustrations sometimes.
So does that mean it's kind of pared back? It's more simplistic than it would normally be?
To some extent, yes. It's not in the same way as we might look at a drawing of, say, if someone drew a pencil drawing of a skull from life, and it would be something that we would perceive to be quite creative and unique. Illustrations for medical textbooks tend to be quite instructive.
Yeah. And so how do you actually do the illustration? Do you do it with pencil and paper, or...?
Well, I mean, you do, despite what people think, you do actually need to know how to draw, even if you're drawing on the computer. So we all train by hand. We can all draw in pencil and watercolour and pen and ink. But for the publishing industry, they really want digital illustrations. So I draw everything digitally. I have a pen tablet and I draw directly onto that now.
All right. So, and that just means that you can actually then manipulate the image later, and it makes things a bit easier to deal with in publishing.
Exactly. You can change, if there's a small amendment that needs to be made, you can do it much simpler than if it was a hand drawing and you would have to completely redraw it.
Does that way of drawing actually make the transition into using anatomical images in an artistic way easy or difficult, or...?
To some extent it can. Certainly you can do things digitally which are much harder to do by hand. So if you want to make a repeat pattern, or you want to make something really clean and crisp, then digital images are great for that because they reproduce really well. But my experience is that people have a much more emotional reaction to hand-drawn images. They have a certain texture and quality to them that I think people... It just resonates with people a lot more in terms of feeling a connection with the drawing.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, strokes that kind of have feeling in them are slightly different from a very technical drawing. Do you still think that maybe you put a bit of that kind of emotion into the strictly anatomical drawings, or is it, do you take a step back and just, all right, I'm just going to draw exactly how it is? Like, how do you get creative in something like an anatomical drawing?
I think that's the trick. I think that's why illustrating for medical textbooks is quite prescribed. You have to usually adhere to a certain colour palette and a certain style to stick to the theme of the book. Whereas if you're doing your own artwork, you're doing it for yourself, you can choose the subject matter, you can choose how you want to illustrate it, and it gives you so much more freedom in terms of creativity.
And so you've now kind of made a transition in that you're doing a lot of stuff in that with a bit more freedom, with a bit more artistic. What images, what things make the best transition into art?
I mean, for anatomy, anything does, but in terms of your audience, it depends who you're aiming it for. And certainly, I think people are becoming a lot more aware of anatomy, which is great. But certainly we've had images of the skull, which I think lots of people will appreciate, have had a dramatic rise over the last few years. Skulls have been everywhere in fashion and just absolutely everywhere. I think anything that has an emotional reaction in the viewer like that. So the skull is visibly a face, so humans recognise that as a face, so it has an automatic connection. And the next anatomical part that's becoming like that is now the human heart, and we're seeing more and more human anatomical heart images on everything. And again, it has an emotional reaction in people because they kind of put the link with the heart and love and anatomy, and so they tend to translate really well for audiences.
And the shape of the heart does kind of, you know, if you squint, represent the kind of cartoon heart that you imagine with just two lobes, right? If you kind of turn it in the right way, maybe it kind of looks the same, or is that just made up?
Yeah, I mean, no two hearts are the same, and that's the great thing. When you get in the dissection room, I always ask all my students to go and look at all the other cadavers, not just theirs, because they're always really amazed at how everybody's heart looks completely different. So yeah, I think you could use a little bit of artistic license and think it looks like the cartoon heart.
Brilliant. So we're going to move on to your next song, which is a Chopin piece. This is Piano Preludes, Opus 28, number 4 in E minor, and it's by Grigory Sokolov. Why did you choose this one?
Yes, so I'm really lucky that if I'm drawing all day, I can listen to music all day long and just draw, which is sublime. And depending what kind of mood I want to be in and what I want to create, I can listen to, usually I pick classical music to listen to, and I play piano. This is a piece that I play, and part of the reason why I like it is that it's so powerful, yet it's so simple. And I think that lots of people think, as with art and music, that something has to be really complicated to be able to appreciate the artistry, but I actually think a lot of the time something that's really simple and really powerful is much harder to create.
Renaissance artists became anatomists by necessity as they attempted to refine a more lifelike sculptural portrayal of the human figure.
Science News!
Orangutan kiss squeaks might reveal the origin of language.
We can freeze the norovirus away.
New organ named in digestive system.
Mathematics can reveal the inside of the earth.
Being mentally well is less normal than first expected.
Okay, being mentally well than first expected. What does this mean? I don't understand.
So there was a study in New Zealand where they looked into the mental health of 988 participants, and they checked in with them between the ages of 11 and 38, and they found that only 17% were deemed to have not had any mental health issues in this time. And so I think that's really important and interesting, because I think it suggests that although we have this massive stigma on mental health, obviously we need to do more studies. This was only in New Zealand, but it's sort of saying that it feels like a lot of people struggle with this in their lifetime.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's quite interesting. That's a very high percentage of people.
I know. I was very surprised.
Well, so it's fine. Don't worry about it. You know, it's everyone has it.
It's all good.
You're talking about a new organ, Emily. What's this? A whole new organ?
Yeah, well, it's something we've known about, but it's been classified as an organ now. So a part of the digestive system called the mesentery has been reclassified as an organ following research at the University of Limerick. So the mesentery is a part of the intestine that kind of connects the intestine to the stomach, and it was previously thought to be made up of lots of different parts, but they've recently decided to reclassify it as one organ. So there are now 79 organs in the human body, and the medical textbook Grey's Anatomy has been updated to include the mesentery.
So how do you decide the difference between an organ? Because I'm imagining, like, for instance, I don't know, is all of your skin one organ? Or is it divided up into different organs?
Yes, your skin is an organ. So it's essentially something that works in the same way to do a purpose.
So I found out about these orangutan kiss squeaks. So this was researchers at Durham and John Moore University in Liverpool. They analysed 4,486 kiss squeaks collected from 48 animals in four wild populations. And so these sounds are a kind of consonant-like sound, and I'm going to have to do an impression of one. It's kind of a bit like... it's really interesting because you can't go back to the origin of language, you know, unless you had a time machine, which would be brilliant. And the way that we can look at how language started out and how things kicked off is by looking at great apes and seeing how it happened. And what was really interesting in this research is that they found that using these kiss squeaks, they actually had multiple words for the same thing. So they have a kind of redundancy in the language where two of the sounds mean the same thing. And they think that this is kind of the origin of how you start associating separate ideas to things. If you have multiple sounds for the same thing, then you can communicate and say it's definitely this thing. You don't have ambiguity. And then that kind of starts building in these like defined ideas. And then that kind of affects how you think and everything like that. So I found this incredibly fascinating. The only other thing, Louise, was we can freeze the norovirus away.
Yes. Yes, we can. Well... I'm not sure how much everyone knows about the norovirus, but it's mainly a foodborne virus. And currently, one of the ways that people are dealing with it is by sterilising food through heat. But one of the problems is that you can't sterilise raw, like food that you can eat raw, so fruit and vegetables with heat, because that would obviously damage them. So they've started to think about other ways they could do it. And a university in America... they found that they can use cold plasma to sterilise the food beforehand. They actually did it on some romaine lettuce. Right. And they found that 99% of the norovirus went when they used cold plasma. And apparently this has also been seen on chicken and a few other things. So it's really exciting news for... also obviously could have sort of implications outside of the norovirus. But for the norovirus, which was obviously so big last winter, to know that hopefully... we can cut down the likelihood of it next winter because we can either freeze or heat the virus away.
So you get a couple of options now of sterilising your food. That's pretty good. Okay, so we're going to move on to your next song, Emily, which is Florence and the Machine.
Yeah, so I've actually met Florence and we share a hairdresser as well. So I really love her work. I love her lyrics. I like the fact that her lyrics are quite visceral. She's often mentioning organs and she's talking about her emotions in regard to her anatomy. So naturally, that appeals to me.
Keep it alive.
Leonardo da Vinci, who lived from 1452 to 1519, is well known for his anatomical sketches of the human body. He would dissect dead human remains and then draw what he saw.
So that was quite a long time ago, right? Da Vinci drawing his own. Apparently he drew that on his own, which is quite weird among anatomists.
Yeah, I mean, he's obviously Leonardo da Vinci is always referenced when you talk about anatomy and art, but he really did stand outside of most of the other anatomists and surgeons that were teaching. He really was someone that was just genuinely curious for his own right of dissecting and wanting to document what he was finding.
So you think anatomy's kind of, you know, become more popular recently, passing to art and popular culture. Do you think that people's opinion has changed within the, you know, the last few years or decades? Or?
Oh, definitely, definitely. When I went off to university 20 years ago now, I remember having to really explain to people what anatomy was, as opposed to kind of medicine and other elements of science. But now people have really embraced it. And I think that's been partly due to our awareness of fitness and exercise and health. I've illustrated a lot of books over recent years that are anatomy of running, anatomy of yoga, anatomy of exercise. So people are actually aware of where their a particular muscle is, you know, this bit in my leg hurts, and they'll Google it and find out what you know, why their thigh hurts when they run or something like that, which you just couldn't do a few years ago. So it's just, it's more easily available on the internet now, and so people can research their own anatomy, which is fantastic.
Yeah, so I guess there are lots of books that are kind of like, you know, introduction to anatomy, and they have these beautiful drawings in them. You've done some of your books. What kind of stuff are you putting in those that people are liking to look at, and you're finding people are wanting to read more?
My own books,
yes,
that I'm creating.
Yeah.
So following my shop, Anatomy Boutique, I was quite intrigued by the fact that people really seemed to like reframing anatomy, so that it wasn't just an anatomical textbook. It wasn't necessarily this academic subject of the elite that only if you were a doctor you could understand. So I wanted to kind of marry that together with my experience of publishing and create books that were more artistically designed for coffee table books of anatomy, essentially. So I created a book called Anatomy in Black, which was published in 2015, which is essentially, I wanted to create a grown-up, elegant, sexy anatomy book, basically.
Yeah, so it's, some of the images from these books are beautiful. You've chosen a really interesting colour scheme to kind of show things off. Why did you choose that?
Yeah, so I chose the book to be entirely in black and gold. And that was the kind of most popular colourway of the wallpaper that I do as well, the black and gold. I think there's something just very decadent and elegant about that colourway. And yeah, we released the book in October 2015, and I just didn't know how it was going to be received, but people absolutely loved it. We sold out in a matter of days, and that has inspired me now to launch this year. I'm launching an imprint publishing house that's just documenting contemporary art and anatomy.
Oh yeah, so there's been a big rise within contemporary art of anatomy, and you know, I'm assuming that when people talk about this, they hear about the very, you know, famous things like Damien Hirst's thing. But you're saying that it's a much wider movement within contemporary art.
There's a huge movement at the moment with contemporary artists using anatomy in their work, which is really exciting. It's definitely something that's happened over the last 10 years. Last year, I wrote a book called Anatomy Rocks, which documents about 60 contemporary artists that use anatomy in their work. So it's still quite fringe, which I like. It's quite alternative, but there's a lot of contemporary artists out there that are being inspired by the beauty of anatomy.
And yeah, so I was reading up a little bit about this. I was actually interested, going back, we were talking about Da Vinci before. Actually, historically, there's been a lot of art in anatomy, and I was looking at some of the original drawings by Vesalius, where he was like original, and he had anatomical drawings of people with flayed skin, but in a like pastoral landscape. I find it interesting that there's always been that kind of place of anatomy in art. What do you think about that? What do you think that more needs to be done with those anatomical things to bring them into art, or do they just happen to work?
Well, it's quite interesting because if you look at the timeline of artists and anatomists, there's definite phases that this movement has moved through. And hundreds of years ago, and you're talking about Vesalius, these anatomists were at a time where they were still seeing human beings as the handiwork of God. And what they were trying to employ fine artists to do, and you referenced Vesalius's Fabrica, human Fabrica, which has the flayed bodies in pastoral landscapes. And it's the thinking that it's Titian's studio that created those etchings. Right. And they would employ these incredible fine artists to really try and capture the magnificence and the splendour of the human body. So fine artists and anatomists have gone together in really trying to show how incredible the human body is. But what happened in the 20th century with the First and Second World War is there was such a huge leap in the advancements of surgery that they needed to actually get not fine artists, but a trained medical artist, professionals trained up to be able to document all these surgical procedures, almost in manuals so people could follow them. So that kind of brings us up to present day. But what's happening in the last 10 years is that things are changing again, and contemporary artists aren't being employed by the anatomists anymore. They're not within the confines of an anatomist saying, I want you to show this, that and that. They're actually using anatomy as their muse. They're using it as their topic, and they're exploring anatomy in their own right. So for anatomical art, it's a really exciting time at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's now anatomy is relevant, as relevant now as it ever was, and even more so. But Emily, thank you so much for coming in. That's all we've got time for today. How can people see your work, and how can they find you on social media?
Yes, so my website, which is emilyevansillustration.com, that has all the links to my publishing house and my shop on it, or you can find me on Twitter at AnatomyUK.
Brilliant. And just finally, before we have your last song, we have the answer to our brain teaser.
So for everyone, just to recap, it was bulbs of Krauss, camphus, legfum, and glabella. And we asked you how many of these were real. So we've had a few answers in. Miriam thinks that two are correct. Tim thinks they all are. But I can tell you that three of them are correct. So legfum was the rogue one. We made that up. I personally honestly thought it might have been bulbs of Krauss, but as Emily was saying earlier, what did you say bulbs of Krauss was again?
They're in the skin, they're for proprioception.
Oh, cool.
See, it was a bit cheating because we've got an anatomist on the other side of the table who knew exactly what they all were, so we didn't bother asking her. But anyway, so thank you very much. You can find us on at Science Mixtape on Twitter and Instagram and all of the other social media aspects. You can listen again to all our previous shows on iTunes or your favourite podcast app. And thank you again, Emily. And what's our last song for you to play out on?
So the last song I've chosen is the Rolling Stones' You Can't Always Get What You Want, which is perfect for someone that runs their own business because you have to scrape yourself up and brush yourself off and start again. So this is a good mantra for life.
Try sometimes, well, you might find.
For more Science Mixtape, you can find our shows on Audioboom, iTunes, or any other podcast provider. Or join us live every Saturday at 10 a.m. on Soho Radio, recently voted the best online radio station in the world.
Science.